No, Christianity's got a problem. If you understand it, if you understand it right, and don't distort it and change it, you can't believe it. Particularly this chapter. You'd be surprised how many people lack the intellectual energy and courage to think through their religious faith just give it a lip service and translate it into something that it is not. I remember when I was teaching in college in the Midwest, before I was sufficiently captured by God to abandon what I was trained to do, I was in a college where the president freely admitted that he could not reconcile his academic training. He was working on a doctorate at the time, not having completed it, in psychology. He freely admitted he could not reconcile his academic discipline with his Christian faith. But it felt good when he went to church and worshiped. So he just parked his academic discipline and that part of his brain outside the church. Came in and released the emotions and the feelings in the church group that he had grown up in, and the liturgy and the music and the poetic sounds. And then he parked that at the church door as he walked out. And went back to his academic frame of mind and never did the two meet. You thought I was kidding when I said it's not believable. Very few Christians believe in the resurrection. They believe in it until you stop and say what it means. But the one who went about making such claims about himself that he was either a madman or a fake, because no mortal man could believe the impossible claims he made about himself unless he was mad. And if he didn't believe them, he was a phony, fooling people. And if that man who made those ridiculous claims died and as prophesied 3 days later, came out of a tomb as reported, needing no one to unwrap the grave clothes, but through the grave clothes, through a rock that had been placed over the tomb, because his enemies in insecurity had heard the prophecy of the resurrection and were afraid his body might be stolen and a false story peddled. This rock over the tomb, he went through it. Any of you tried to walk through a wall lately? Linda, you want to tell us what solid things feel like? The stone was rolled away. This is not my message today, by the way. That's the message on Easter Sunday. But it's preparation for this unbelievable story. The stone was rolled away not to let Jesus out, but to let the testifiers of the resurrection in to see that he was gone. He went through the rock, through a locked door where his disciples were gathered, the unbelievable one, or the one unbelieving one, Thomas, said, I won't believe this until I put my hand in the print of the resurrection, the crucifixion wounds. Who then sailed off in the blue. Jesus, the floating one, sailed off in the blue. With angels saying, why gaze ye up into heaven? This same Jesus you see going away shall in like manner come again. I'm going very slow. I'll be sorry for this as my time begins to click for the main part of the message. But I insist most Christians don't believe this. Oh, yeah, they believe it like poetry. But Paul said, if Christ be not risen, our faith is vain. And he wasn't talking poetry. Furthermore, we are false witnesses, for we have testified that God raised him up. He didn't talk about some kind of spiritual concept. Churches, for the next few weeks, probably in every city in America, some church will be singing the song, you ask me how I know he lives. The answer, he lives within my heart. I've attended Shinto sect meetings in Japan. They could testify to the heartfelt feelings of their religion. And that kind of argument, your subjective feelings to demonstrate a faith in Jesus Christ, is nothing but modern Gnosticism. You know something because of some subjective personal experience that no one else knows. It may be valid for you. I do not deny that. But it is no proof of Christianity to someone else. That's your feeling. And that is not the way Christianity ran its flag up in the New Testament, a scattered band of doubters destroyed because they didn't even believe he would rise, are transformed with a testimonial of a fact. Paul names those to whom he appeared and says there were above 500 brethren at one time that he appeared to, of whom the greater part, Paul speaking, are alive to this day, and he could assemble the eyewitnesses. Some are asleep or dead. And if Christ be not risen, our faith is vain. We're liars, and there's no basis for the Christian testimony. That's why I want you at the new home on Easter Sunday as we cover the objective proofs of the resurrection and the basis of faith. Now, you know, growing up in the church, I became an agnostic for 3.5 years. I came back to Christianity not because of some shining light or feelings up and down my spine, but a hard, cold, 3.5 year study of the facts of the resurrection. And I've told you many times, I've yet to meet a person in this life, college, university, and out of it, that denies the resurrection, but what I can ask him 15 questions and prove he has not spent 15 hours of his life looking at the evidence. The usual approach is, it couldn't happen, therefore it didn't happen, and anyone who says it did is either a deluded, gullible fool or a liar, because it can't happen, therefore it didn't happen. Therefore, anybody says it did, liar. So why bother to read him? Because it can't happen, didn't happen, shouldn't be said, don't even talk about it, didn't happen, because it can't happen, round and round in a circle you go. The Christian says, by any concept that I know. It can't happen. And if it happened to this person who made these unusual claims about himself, then that person becomes the center of my attention and the basis of the fundamental and first New Testament doctrine of the church is thus brought into being. God was in Christ. You don't need any bigger definition of God than that. But it's based upon a fact, not fancy. And that's why I've been in the business for these last however many years since my faith was restored of demystifying Christianity. You don't have to park your brain at the door of the church to be a Christian. But that doesn't mean it's easy. You work your faith out on solid foundations. But it's still unbelievable. And you have to be convinced by the facts. Now, today's message is to this church. For 14 consecutive years, and in a few weeks, the 15th time, I will present the faith foundations of Christianity as I retrace the steps that gave me faith from my agnosticism. This message is to the congregation that already has that foundation, who tends to slip into the frame of reference of the world and become doubting believers, unable to marshal any faith. And you look at these New Testament stories and Old Testament stories the way my associate at that university did. It's something you clap about, feel good about in church on Sunday morning, and mentally say hooray. But any dumb fool knows it can't be true in today's age. Now, I have to cross this hurdle with you mentally today before I go to the message, because why waste 30 minutes talking about a New Testament miracle that none of you believe? And I'm telling you, it's unbelievable. Walking on water. Most people view these stories as some far-off myth or something as ridiculous. You know, every week I wonder what new story they're telling on me. Somebody saw me up at Lake Arrowhead walking my duck on water. I want you out of that mood. If Christ be not risen, our faith is vain. I'm not going to give you the evidence today. That's next Easter, a few weeks from now. But if Christ be not risen, our faith is vain. And by the way, ushers, go find the blower back here because it's too hot. How many are too hot? Good. There's nothing wrong with me then. I thought I was having hot flashes or something. Is somebody going, ushers? I hear it. Oh, that was the door open over there. Get this cooler going. I need cool heads for what I'm going to say. If Christ be not risen, our faith is vain. I give you no evidence today. I just talk in the frame. Assume the resurrection. Not the way most Christians assume it. Some poetry. Assume that a rock more solid than this piano, a man dead 3 days, came out of the tomb and foresaw it, by the way, and prophesied it would happen. Through the locked door, and sailed off in the blue. You know, I'm not an unconscious preacher. I can feel it. And the tragedy is, even in my congregation, there's some that can't comprehend the reality of this yet. That's the basis of your faith. I don't need Christianity. If that claim is false, Christianity is a troublemaking, meddlesome, interfere with your life, miserable philosophy. It was not true. Confucius had a better golden rule than Jesus. Jesus' golden rule is do unto others you wish to be done unto. Please don't. That's why I hate the church. They've been doing to me as they want to be done to for too many years. We got an earthquake? Blowers are gone. Without God's Spirit indwelling and the change of nature that the power of God brings to a life that is based upon the resurrection, do unto others as you want to be done unto is an excuse for pushing your ideas on somebody else. Confucius said, don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. That's a much more practical and pragmatic way of life if God doesn't exist. If He doesn't exist, I want to be protected from you. So don't do to me what you don't want done to yourself. Please don't do to me what you want done to yourself. Until your nature changes, what you want done to yourself, I don't want done to me. If you're going to be a Christian, be a Christian. And it starts with a miracle. Don't believe in miracles? Why are you a Christian? Now there's the four out nutty friends that have peddled their fakery on the church world. I still remember attending a meeting of A.A. Allen down in Atlanta, Georgia. I was up in the third balcony, and I just bought a brand new Homburg. And the organ player in one of those southern evangelistic style meetings that would make John look like a conservative Episcopal priest was going, whoom, whoom, whoom. And they started going. And some family right in front of me with a teenage daughter decided they were going to dance in the spirit, I guess, whatever that means. And she got going, and the balcony was kind of steep, and she lost her balance, and wouldn't you know it, right on my Homburg. If I'd have been saved at the time, I'd have backslid. I wanted to kill her. And he healed some boy with crutches. And I saw the boy the next day with the crutches crossing the street. We are fed up to here with the phonies that have exploited the non-thinking aspect of Christianity. But that does not nullify the miraculous, faith-based foundation of Christianity, which is the purpose of this church. Jesus Christ coming out of the tomb is the most staggering miracle I can conceive. And if I can believe that, then I can believe the rest. Now, my dad doesn't have the difficulties I have. I envy him. Dying in a coma condition with rheumatic fever. And as a boy, this picture never left me as I watched him dwindle from his 6'2", 180-pound frame down to 125 pounds. And lying in a coma. God sovereignly blessed him with a vision and literally raised him from death's door. With a vision and a call into the ministry, saying, preach my word, I'll heal you. All the doctors that said if he lived, he'd have heart trouble are long gone, and he's still going. That is an experience God never deigned to let me have. I never had visions like that. I had to work it out from hard study. But in a sense, my faith has become stronger for that reason. It's based upon
fact, hard fact, not subjective experience. And this half of this message is a preview of Easter Sunday as I lay the bases of that fact. But please understand, this is introduction to the simple statement: if you don't have the capacity to believe in miracles, you need to start your faith over again at the foundation. Because that's where it starts. Too many people have latched on to a trunk of the Christian tree, or rather a limb of the Christian tree, hanging out here, looking at it from their self-critical viewpoint, never having paid the price of going to the foundation and seeing it starts with a miracle that is the crossroads and beginning of faith. I always go back to that when I come to these difficult passages, because it's so dang unbelievable. I have to put it in the perspective of the resurrection. And as I study this chapter, I understand why Jesus said, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, so little, like the head of a pin, you can move mountains. Which puts in perspective my 35-year journey toward faith after settling the foundation. You take a microscope by comparison, the most developed one by comparison. My faith, in comparison to the mustard seed, is like my height, a simple 6 feet in relationship to the distance between the earth and the sun. That's about what my faith level is in relationship to a mustard seed. A little faith goes a long way. That's the introduction. Because I'm going to talk about the unbelievable. And when you think about it in the context given, it's no harder to believe that someone can walk on water than it is to believe Jesus can raise from the dead. And if you're going to sit there mentally arguing with a water-walking incident, you're going to miss the principle of faith I want to teach. Go back to the foundation. Did he rise? If you're here not believing it today, how many hours have you spent on the evidence? Frank Morrison, who moved the stone, the lawyer that set out to disprove it, ended up writing the greatest proof that I know of in print. Sherlock's Trial of the Witnesses, classic text that postulates a courtroom scene under rules of evidence and has the witnesses present the case for the resurrection. Or to you who watch on television, have you been to my Easter service where I present the evidence every single year? I do this at this church because I remember the disappointment when Canon Brian Green, who came from England to a mission at Stanford University, and who helped me put my focus in the right place on the uniqueness of Christ and the absolute choice that is forced upon you when you understand the Christ of history, and who promised to preach on a resurrection. I took my mother there, and he didn't do it. For some schedule reason, he jumped over that and said, I'll do it next time I come to Stanford, and he never did. I grew up in the church, told to believe it, and nobody would present me the evidence. I had to dig the classics like those that I've just named to you out. And Easter Sunday, I do that, but I'm saying to you today, to this church who believes, what are you struggling with walking on water for if you believe the resurrection? And it is in a miracle frame this message flows, and I've been on it for 3 Sundays, John 6. Gee, after these things, that's all in induction. Jesus went across the Sea of Galilee, and this is a very important incident in Christ's life because all four of the gospel writers recorded, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. A great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles. which he did on them that were diseased. Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh. And when Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, now he'd led him into a wilderness place, and here's this multitude, later to be numbered as 5,000 men, and using current TV figures, which I think is considerably conservative, because they had more kids in those days than we do now. 2.2 persons is the average per family. So 5,000 men, not counting women and children, means we're talking more like 12,000 people. Followed him into this wilderness. Jesus then lifted up his eyes, saw a great company come unto him, and he said unto Philip, "Whence shall we buy bread?" Philip, "Whence shall we buy bread?" Everybody cough. Come on. Again. One more time, you get it all out. Now suck in your breath and really go for it. I take care of your needs. Pay attention. Jesus said unto Philip, "Whence shall we buy bread?" Buy bread. That these 12,000 may eat. Now we've covered this. I'll probably bore you today on this. Probably already. Jesus is asking me for help. Now we've covered the fact. You go to another gospel, you find that Jesus called Philip from Bethsaida. This is a message I want you to have memorized. Now you've heard this, haven't you? You read another gospel, Philip was called from Bethsaida. So he was the logical one to ask if you're expecting a natural answer and not a miracle. And you have to go to another gospel other than John 6 to find that this place where the multitude had followed them was in the outskirts of Bethsaida, the Decapolis, or 10 cities along the circle of the Galilee Sea and on the east side in the desert place. So it takes three gospels to get the factual frame. They were near Bethsaida, Sea of Galilee, Jordan River pouring out of the base. You drive around this side, there's a little village up there where the demoniac lived that cast the demons out of and went into the pig. And around this Sea of Galilee was the Decapolis, 10 cities in Jesus' day. And they were in a wilderness area near Bethsaida, a little closer than that. Now, Philip came from that area, and they were at that area. Two separate Gospels tell us that. And now John's Gospel has him say to Philip. Other Gospels say he asked the disciples, but this one specifies Philip, which becomes one of those internal proofs of the accuracy of the reporters of these Gospel stories, because if they were fakers, none of them knew the others were writing. And yet it takes three separate Gospels to get an accurate factual picture of what went on. So he's the logical choice. Philip, where shall we buy bread? But as we preached two Sundays ago, Jesus was not interested in food but that question. Here are the disciples that had accepted he was the incarnate Word of God. Here are the disciples developed in a background of faith frame where Moses was the greatest until Jesus came. And Moses, under God's power, led 3.5 million into a wilderness area. Deuteronomy 9 says God led him into the wilderness and made him to hunger that he might prove what was in their heart. And these are the people in a faith frame that believed for 40 years God had fed them with manna from heaven every morning.
I once calculated how many train loads of bread it took that manna fallen from heaven to feed 3.25 or 3.5 million people that Moses led out of Egypt. These are people in the faith frame that believe that Moses not only was God's instrument to bring the plagues on Egypt, they had seen Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments. And anybody knows that the Red Sea rolled back and the miracles that took them out of Egypt. You're still working on your faith frame. A long time since I told you about the kid that came home from Sunday school and his father said to him, "What did you learn in Sunday school today?" He said, "Well, there was this general called Moses taking people out of Egypt, and the Egyptian army was right on their tail. The tanks were charging and the guns were booming. And Moses radioed his engineers and said, 'You build some pontoons over that Red Sea. We've got to get out of here quick.' And the engineers went to work on it. And Moses radioed them and said, 'Now, after you get the pontoons built, you put some explosives in them and you rig it so that we can time the explosion.' And they did properly. They built the pontoons, they put the explosions in it. Moses marshaled all of his army, tanks and trucks and guns, and they rumbled over the pontoons, and when they got on the other side, here came Pharaoh and his army. Tanks and trucks charging onto the pontoons, following them. Moses radioed his engineers and says, 'Punch that plunger,' and he punched the plunger, and kablow, boom, boom, up went everything, and Moses blew the pontoons up, and Pharaoh and his army and tanks and guns and everything went in the sea." Father looked at him and said, "Son, your Sunday school teacher didn't tell you that story, did he?" He said, "Well, not exactly, but you'd never believe it the way she told it to me." Go ahead and laugh. That's the way we are. These people to whom Jesus was talking had the faith frame that should have presumed miracle working exactly as Christians should presume miracle powers of God. And what Jesus was after, when did he ever buy anything? When he needed to pay taxes, he called a fish to the shore and took a coin out of his mouth. He was giving Philip an opportunity for faith. Philip had the opportunity of a lifetime. He could have said, "We don't have to buy food, Master. You're greater than Moses. And he fed him with bread from heaven. Just tell me how to get in line for the miracle you're going to perform." But immediately he started counting pennies. "God, deliver me from this kind of church, the Philippians." Jesus said, "When shall we buy bread that these may eat?" And the sixth verse says he was tricking him. God's a trickster on occasions. As he's setting this church up, nobody else in town has faith to tackle the downtown. How can we do it? "When shall we buy bread that these may eat?" This he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. Jesus knew exactly what he was going to do. He was going to provide a miraculous provision, but he tricks poor old Philip. He should have set him up with some kind of cue. We even set horses up with a cue. You don't say to a horse, "What gate do you want to do?" Jesus could have said, "Now, Philip, we've had several miracles that you've watched, and here's your chance to get in a miracle frame with me. What miracle should we provide for these people?" Then Philip could have said, "Well, today let's try turning stones to bread. There are a lot of them around here." Even Satan thought of that when Jesus was in the wilderness.
He set him up. He even used a natural phrase. Where shall we go to buy bread? What a dirty trick. You're supposed to set an atmosphere for miracles. Why didn't Jesus make a light materialize? Get him all primed. Like these miracle services. Remember the guy you say, now this phenomenon follows our ministry. When I lay hands on you, they tend to fall. Now I don't want it to frighten you. And don't resist the Spirit. By the time he got done psyching them in, he could have walked up to an oak tree and it would have fell. You're not supposed to perform miracles without a... Don't expect me, God, to believe in a miracle if you aren't getting me in a miracle frame. I mean, I'm busy. I got... My feet hurt from walking out here. And I've heard what you've taught so many times. My mind's elsewhere. And you say to me, where shall we go to buy food? Well, he knew where all the 7-Elevens were in Bethsaida. He had grown up there. What did Jesus expect from him? Some spiritual response? If he wanted a spiritual response, why didn't he use spiritual words? Why buy? Are you on the same planet with me? I mean, I'm so tired of Christianity and religion being tooled out in some never-never land. You got to forsake life. You got to stop breathing. You got to get out here in some kind of posture. Now miracles are going to happen. I've gotten myself ready. You've probably gotten yourself ready for a delusion. The whole concept of Christianity. God was in Christ. The Word was with God of the same essence as God. This St. John says, facing God, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. He moved from eternity and struck a tent in human flesh called Jesus of Nazareth and walked ordinary streets where men and women could see what God was like in the ordinariness of life. The church has been hurling God back into mystery land ever since. If there's ever going to be a miracle that happens in your life, it'll happen because you live in an expectancy of faith in an ordinary frame of reference. Faith didn't necessarily have to make Linda, for example, sprout wings and fly over a barn. Faith trusts God if He has to take you through the crises by guiding the surgeon's knife and the ordinary events of your life, when to which He intrudes His finger of care without making it so obvious. Jesus didn't get up on a rock and say, there are 12,000 here, but I'd rather have 15 because I'm about to perform a big miracle. Get an ad in the Bethsaida Times. Come and see miracles today. Again, I ask, you on the same planet with me? No wonder the respected, ordinary world is disappointed in Christianity, in its manufactured fakery. The paradox rope I walk today is that of a preacher who believes in miracles. But without all the falls of all, Philip had a chance. Just as we have a chance every day in the ordinariness of life to have our first reaction, non-fading, think small, see only the things of time, never think of God and His promise, versus seeing in the ordinariness of life the opportunity to pause before you take your first step and think how God's promises play upon that event and turn it into an opportunity of faith in God's promises. Instead, all Philip can do, even though Jesus was testing him, he asked him the question, knowing what he, Jesus, would do, giving to Philip the opportunity to tune himself faith-wise, instead all he did was say, Philip answered him, 200 pennyworth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. One of his disciples, well, let's end with Philip here, 200 pennyworth is not sufficient. I've been on this for 2 weeks now. And I want to make it hit Los Angeles today. When you have an opportunity from God's Word to respond to a question that's there, what's your first reaction? You count your pennies? And see how foreshort the opportunity falls? 200 pennyworth. There's 12,000 people here. Jesus, you don't know how to count? That's real faith, isn't it? God incarnate. He has to tell him that 200 pennyworth of bread won't feed all of them one bite. God, I hope I live long enough for stupid people to quit coming up with answers like that to questions I ask. How God must feel. I watched a movie on video last night. And Sean Connery plays the father of Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade. And it's kind of funny to watch Sean Connery play a part of a fumblebug college professor who has moments of brilliance, but can be so stupid. And they're in that plane, and there's a bunch of German planes after them shooting at them. And Indiana Jones turns around and says to his father, says, you're going to have to use that machine gun. And so here comes a German plane shooting at him, and he's about to line up his machine gun, and Indiana Jones says, 11 o'clock! And his father takes his watch out and checks the time. Philip, where shall we go to buy bread? The Lord of glory is asking this question. The creator of the universe. Read Hebrews 7, the seven things about Jesus. God used Jesus to speak the words. He was the outring of God's glory, the express image of God's nature in human flesh. And he, by his words, spoke, and not a thing became everything. The basis of faith is God spoke his word. Nothing became everything. By that same word, all things consist, and by that same word, these heavens and earths will be made over again. Heaven and earth will pass away, and that word will stand forever, and that word had become flesh, and that word was now speaking to Philip, and giving Philip an opportunity to go in partnership with him. And just to see where his mind was, he said, where can we go buy bread? And sure enough, Philip said, for 200 pennies we'll not buy enough bread for these 12,000. Don't you know how to count, Lord? No wonder there's so many stars in the universe. He can't count. God can't heal me or cooperate in my healing process. He only created the universe. Turn unto me, the promise is, and I'll turn unto you. Well, nice to have you looking, God, but he can't do anything with my pennies. I mean, he can create the world, but he can't do anything with my pennies. I've been laying the promises of giving on this church. The creator of the universe can't provide. Phillips. Downcast, penny-counting view cost him the greatest opportunity to be immortalized as a compatriot of Christ in the miracle. Jesus knew what he was going to do. Peter just couldn't believe it. Andrew is much better. One of his disciples, Andrew, said, there's a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. Now we go to Andrew.
His view.
Philip.
No faith.
Andrew. Have faith. Andrew says, well, there's a lad here I'm bringing to you. He's got 5 loaves, little barley loaves, and 2 fishes. If he had just stopped. If he had just kept his mouth shut. I've been telling this church for 14 years, if you can't talk faith, shut up. Every year I preach on Gideon. Down in that vineyard, in a wine press, so he can hide himself lower, threshing wheat. You don't thresh wheat in a vineyard. He was hiding from the Midianites. An angel of the Lord appeared and said, Daniel, the Lord is with thee, or rather Gideon, the Lord is with thee, the one who's mighty in valor. Well, if you're with me, Lord, why this, if that, when, where, what? Alas!
What have I said to you? You get rid of that vocabulary of doubt. Are you trying to brainwash this congregation?
Right! You got it! If there's anything we need, it's our brainwashed of that tendency always to go to the negative. I'm not Christian Science. I don't say you're not sick when you are sick. When I'm sick, I'm sick. I really get sick when I get sick. I never say that you fail to be broke. I just say a true Christian's never poor. Broke, but not poor. You need your mind washed of doubts and penny counting. Penny saves, penny off, long. It's like this maxim, early to bed, early to rise, makes a man wealthy and wise, healthy and wealthy and wise, loney. That peddled to those that get up late, that have people who work for them that get up early for them. Make void the Word of God by our traditions. Your brainwashing has a bad connotation. Well, there's just a lot of dirty brains around. What do you do when there's dirt? Quit being worked over with propaganda terms. Hey! Oh, if Andrew had kept his mouth shut. Here, Lord, is a boy with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. But the number of people that have become infamous with their butts. Infamous butts. Andrew's one. There's a lad with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Small fishes. You notice how he helps the Lord out. Small fishes. I get so tired of him calling every Sunday afternoon. Here's my offering I'm pledging. It's not much. So don't you dare, Pastor, believe that we'll reach our goal. Get your eyes on the not muchness of what we're giving. How many times have I told you? The habit of recognizing God's provision is what I'm after. I don't care if it's a dollar. First, don't give anything to this ministry unless I've taught you. Don't give it if I've taught you except as a testimonial of the value of the teaching. But then be habitual in giving something, raising your hand to eternity and saying as every week begins, I'm in your hands, Lord. And here's my testimonial. That's faith. Then don't say, but it's not much. Just a dollar this week, but it's not much. Small dollars. But what are they among so many? Just in case, Jesus, Philip didn't make you pause and count. I'm going to be a little more delicate. Philip was a bit crude. I admit, Lord, he said, 200 pennyworth won't feed this band. And maybe he made you mad by the way he said it, you didn't listen, so I'll be delicate with God. Just in case. Here are 5 loaves and 2 small fishes. But what is that among so many? Yeah, come to think of it, Philip. Send them away and let you and I eat this. Half faith. You know, I've come to the point, as I come to the close of this message, I don't care whether you get anything out of it or not. I'm helping myself. I know what I'm saying. How can we go downtown? Lord, we'll go downtown, but considering how many churches left, we're just little fishes. How can we make an impact among so many and when so many have failed? Now, that's our joint project. If you're an intelligent congregation, they can understand the application of faith. See, I can turn this picture around. In this case, it's how can so little accomplish so much with so many? You can have the same kind of small faith. How can God, so big, be concerned about little old me? Now, my subject matter today is faith. Taking God's promise, grabbing hold of it, and going with it. And that gives me license to depart the context. How many times have you heard me point out to you the New Testament Greek of the New Testament words, God will not tempt you beyond what you're able. But with the temptation, the King James has it, will make a way of escape. The Greek is more precise. For every temptation, those that have committed their lives to God, for every temptation He puts you in, He has already worked out a particular way of escape for you from that particular temptation or test. That means for every individual need in this room today and out there, God in His powerful wisdom and all-knowing abilities has worked out a way of escape and put a key in the door already. Well, you know, I'm so insignificant, I'm not going to trouble God with my problem and my need of escape. Fool. He's already got the key in the door. He worked it out before you asked. That's what Jesus was saying when He said, a sparrow doesn't fall without God seeing it. The hairs of your head are numbered. I'm back on miracle foundation, folks. And these, to me, are the greater miracles than some wart disappearing off of somebody's hand. The ability to get a congregation to understand that God knows where you are. When Moses fled and was in the wilderness, and the burning bush appeared after those many years, that bush with God's presence in it didn't say, hey, shepherd, come over here. Hey, you! After 40 years in that wilderness, God spoke from that bush and said, Moses. 40 years, no contact. But when God appeared, He knew His name and right where He was. He said, Moses. God knows where you are. He knows your problem. He knows your needs. I'm talking faith and expectancy. Having done all to stand and expect God's deliverance. I've been counted out all my life by my enemies. The thing they fail to count is what they don't see. The one to whom I've committed my life, and he sees me through. I don't mean that kind of mental midget faith that has one box to pray for God to help him knock another boxer out. I'm talking about that thou knowest my down sittings, as the psalmist said, in mine uprisings. Thou understandest my thoughts afore off. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost part of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely this darkness will cover me, even the night will be light about me, for the day and the night are alike to thee. If I make my bed in hell, thou art there. Wherever, God, who knows our thoughts and understandings, to those that commit in faith, he's there and expects him to see you through. Thou leadest me. The Lord is my shepherd. The steps of a good man are ordered to the Lord. Though he stumble, he shall be lifted up. Promise after promise we've laid down here for 14 years. Don't be like Philip. Well, I'm in a mess. And I've got to count pennies to get out of it. Andrew, well, here's 5 loaves and 2 small fishes. But what is that? Peter's famous for sinking. That proves a negative frame. He's the third one in this. The third player that I've been trying to get to for now 3 messages, and it'll take 4 now. Hopefully I can start right here next Sunday. Andrew had his chance, but what are these among so many? Jesus lined them up, gave them the baskets. They fed the 12,000, 5,000 men plus women and children, and they had 12 basketfuls left over. You believe that story? Why do you think I started out the way I did? Yes, I believe it. And that's preparation for the next one that's even more unbelievable. These fools going up and down the path, taking their basket and seeing the loaves and fishes continue to reproduce. They had the chance to expect that. Remember, they were born and bred on Elijah, who came to the widow that had one meal and said, bring me the first of it, and they kept eating thereafter. Born and bred on Elisha, who had the pots flow and flow and flow with oil as the food was materialized. Born and bred is said already on Moses, who led him for 40 years when bread came from heaven. Now, Jesus is teaching them. Greater than Moses is here. I don't know what happened to their eyeballs as they carried that basket down the ranks. And they take some bread out, and they're still there. And when you get done, there's 12 baskets left over. I'm telling you, when I saw that, if I'd been one of those disciples and Jesus said, get over on the other shore, you think I'd have gotten a boat? I'd have said, look out, here I come. But he fooled. These fool disciples, and I'm telling you, faith builds itself progressively by exposure to what God does in His book. Why teach it? Now, having carried those 12 surplus baskets, you'd think these guys would never doubt anything. But Jesus is still testing their faith. He knew what He was going to do to Philip when He asked him the question. He knew what He was going to do when He led him out there in the wilderness. I keep telling God, God, you can't count. I'll be 61 this August, and you've tested me enough. Now, just lay off. Let me teach what I've learned. And here comes another test. I mean, do you imagine what we would have done if we could have carried those baskets? Man, I ain't going nowhere. I'm just going to sit and look at these 12 baskets. But you get so casual about things of the Spirit, they probably left them there. Jesus then says, go on the other side. Get in the boat. I'm getting in the boat. I'm going to stay here and pray a while. And they get out in the Sea of Galilee, and a storm comes. And they were terrified. terrified. These same ones that had just seen what Jesus did, who professed to be his followers, he sends them, and because a storm comes, they're terrified. Later on, you read the chapter, they're going to wonder when Jesus comes and stills the sea. They're going to sit and wonder in amazement at themselves, and I give them credit for that. They're going to say, why are we amazed that he has stilled the sea when they remember what he did in feeding the 5,000? But in the panic of the moment, out went God. Why did God destroy the Israelites? Hebrews 3 says he got fed up with them always seeing the glass half empty instead of half full. No matter how many times God came through and delivered them, each new test, like a metallurgist, they would put God to test to see if he was still alive, no matter what he had done the previous time. And God said after a while, you got it backwards. You ain't testing me. I was testing your faith, and you didn't pass, so he strode their bones in the wilderness, and Hebrews 3 says, that for our example, and the fourth chapter opens, let us fear lest we wait one day too long before we pick up God's promises and act in faith. Well, I don't preach peddle guilt. The message of the church is to inspire faith. So in the midst of the storm, here comes this shadowy figure. They thought it was a ghost. And they're even more terrified. They got the waves and the wind, and now a ghost. And Jesus, who was that person walking on the water, and you say, you believe that? Come on now, we've covered this ground. He's walking on the water. He says, it's I. And Peter says, if it be you, Lord, bid me come to you. Come. Now, he's remembered for sinking. I want you to know he's walked on more water than anybody other than Jesus. Give him credit. Jesus is going to define his faith. Phillips is no faith. Andrew is little faith, or rather half faith. Jesus is going to define, with a Greek word, Peter's faith as little faith. This little part down here. Jesus said, come, and give him credit. He stepped out of that boat. I mean, get into this with me for just a minute. I'm done in 2 minutes. And he steps over the side. Now, it's not like glass, man. And he steps a few steps toward Jesus on the water. I'm a little surprised at what he did. Knowing Peter as much as I've analyzed his personality, I would have think he'd have said, look, guys! Instead, the fool noticed the waves, like a goose waking up in a new day. Notice the waves and the wind. They were there before he got out. That's what I don't understand about most of you. I do not understand this church at all. Nobody has ever leveled with a congregation more than I have. I've said, you come out of the devil's prison camp and start acting in faith, which is the only way you'll make eternal life. Now you suddenly are on target. This fool gets out of the boat with the wind blowing and the waves pitching and then notices them. Think on that a while. He noticed the wind. He got his eyes off the target of faith. He noticed the waves and the wind. And he began to sink. Now, it doesn't take long to sink. But like that. You tell him how long it takes to hit the ground. No time to count pennies or fish. Maybe fish. That's it, boy. In about 1 second, do I count fish or look at Jesus? And he said, Lord, save me. And Jesus said to him, the Greek has it exact, you little faith man. Why did you double think?
That's what the Greek literally says.
Why did you doubt, is the King James. The Greek is, why did you double think? Now, I'm right where I want to begin next Sunday, God willing. And I'm sorry I'm going to hear an hour after I started, because I'm just getting started. Why did you double think? Either don't get out of the boat, or the hell with the waves and the wind. Keep marching. Why have I got so many of you in this church who double think? It's either the way of faith, or forget it. The waves and wind were there before he sunk and after Jesus stretched forth his hand and picked him up. You say, you believe he walked on water? Too many preachers have said that's irrelevant to the message. I agree it's irrelevant to the message, but I believe he walked on water. I think the difficulty of our faith without Jesus here has got to be measured in relationship to having walked with him and seen his demonstrations, and I sympathize with the fact we can't walk with him and see the demonstrations. And a little bit of faith compared to his little faith, which is mustard seed, compared to what we could have. You grow in faith just like you grow in any other exercise, by the exercise of it. What kind of faith are you going to live? No faith? Counting pennies? I'm going to tell you, you'll be counting pennies till you die. And God will keep leading you into situations that gives you the opportunity and the choice. Or are you going to exercise a little faith and say, well, here it is, Lord, but little faith is better than no faith and half faith. Better to try and think and scream for help and walk some more than to not have faith in the first place. I like people that at least have the gonads, which is 90% of faith, to get out of the boat and give it a whirl. And that's what I'm asking you to do every single week. I want this congregation to not get downtown and turn coward because of the circumstances. That's why I'm putting you through the test of faith before we go. That's the shepherd's task. Yours is the choice. I got a lot of Phillips out there. Well, if you ask me, this is the way it ought to be done, but 200 penny worth won't get it done either. Or here, but watch this little bit among so much. Peter sunk, but he got his eyes back on Jesus, and he walked all the way back to the boat with Jesus. Those are the kind this church wants to build on. If you haven't understood this message, I can't help you anymore.